So how about I open it up, some questions, comments? Yeah.
We think it sounds really wonderful for ourselves. Something that's been on my mind today in particular is something that happened a few nights ago in Cleveland on the 4th of July. We have over 10 people were shot in the city, five of them by one Cleveland firefighter who had long-standing, apparently, pent-up feelings about his noisy neighbors, and he went out and shot five people. And I was reading today in the paper about his co-workers who had known that he was a very short fuse, and they had, you know, kind of jokes and things about it in the firehouse, although he was always very polite and a good co-worker. And it was interesting to hear your starting point about, you know, we all have somebody we want to bring in with us because no one wants to live within. But the truth is, we sometimes have to deal with people who we see are really suffering with a lot of anger and rage. And I'm wondering, beyond these wonderful things for ourselves, is there any kind of idea of what we might do to help these other people who we know are suffering, and we're not necessarily involved with them or the object of their anger, but, you know, worry about what might happen?
Yeah. Okay. So your question is, like, if you're working with a colleague or with somebody else or an acquaintance or a neighbor who you can see has real difficulty with anger, and you don't know what they're in the future going to wind up doing because of their anger, what can we do to help them? It depends a lot on the kind of relationship we have with them. Sometimes if we have a certain kind of relationship, we can just say to them at some point, wow, you seem really unhappy, and get them to try and talk about it a little bit. Yeah. Or sometime when they're upset, you know, if they say, I have a real problem with anger, that can be a door opening to saying, you know, yeah, I've seen that you're really suffering a lot from that. Have you thought about getting some help with it? You know, something like that. Or you get the book Working with Anger and you just leave it around the house. Yeah? You leave it around. I mean, it's amazing. Sometimes, you know, people just leave Dharma books around, their colleagues or family or whoever pick it up, and they read something that's helpful for them. You know? So it depends on the situation, the kind of relationship you have. But if there's the opportunity and the person's open, you know, to talk about it with them and, you know, either hear what they're suffering from or help them find some help for it, or, you know, I read this great book, or, you know, say, have you heard about the Dalai Lama? You know, he's written this book, Healing Anger, that talks about it. You might want to take a look at that.
There seems to be a lot of denial going on, though, from that side.
People deny. What can you do?
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes it's just amazing how you just catch somebody at the right time. I received a letter last winter that was really very, very moving for me. It was from a man who was in prison in Washington State. And he only had a short sentence. It was for violating a restraining order. But it was because, you know, his wife was having an affair with his friend and the marriage broke up and he was just completely enraged about the whole thing. And he wrote me this letter. I didn't know him at all. And he said that he happened to see my book in the prison library, and he happened to read it, and he wrote and he said, I want to thank you for helping me not become a murderer. He said, I was so angry that I was just spending a lot of time plotting, you know, how to get my revenge as soon as I got released, and reading this book helped me to see that that's not what I want to do. And I mean, I was just astounded. But it was like, you know, here just one little book that he happened to see on the library shelf. So you never kind of know the situation where somebody's going to be open to hearing something, you know. And he wasn't a Buddhist. This guy wasn't a Buddhist at all. He was just looking in the library shelf. Other questions? Yeah.
What do you do when you're in a situation and the other person or other people, they're kind of the cause of making you angry and you try to communicate with them? You can't get through to them.
Okay.
And, I mean, one solution is to remove yourself from that situation. But what are some other approaches?
Okay, so you're with a person who's angry, and you're trying to start a conversation about it, and they can't listen. Yeah, so what to do? I know that, scientists talked about something, I think they call it a refractory period, that when an emotion is so strong, during that period when it's so strong, people cannot take in any other information. They can't take in anything that contradicts the view of that emotion. So if we're with somebody who's in that state right now, then I think the best thing to do is just leave them be, you know, because they're not able to take anything in at that time. And so I find it better just to say, you know, I know you're hurting or you're angry, and, you know, let's talk about this later. And, you know, remove myself from the situation and let them cool down, and then go back and talk with them later.
What if it's never like a good time to talk? Like they're never, you can never really communicate.
Okay, so one of those people, huh? Not like any of the people in the room here who's always willing to communicate, right? We're always...
You mentioned like giving criticism, so like in a workplace environment, that was with people who weren't comfortable giving... constructive criticism to me, and I'm very open to that. And so when it came time for my review, like, they weren't happy with my performance, but it was really, I was doing my best, but they weren't, you know, communicating well. And kind of I interpreted that as, you know, I need to be in a better environment where I'm working with people that, you know, communicate better, and it's just a better, you know, dynamic environment in general.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes in that situation that you're saying is you're working with somebody and they didn't give you feedback while you could have used it and then, you know, gave you a write-up at the end. I think sometimes it can be, you know, other people often don't feel comfortable giving people bad feedback because some people think if I tell somebody some bad feedback, they're not going to like me. So what do? They don't tell the person. The person keeps on doing it. And then when they have the opportunity to say it, then they can say it and nobody's going to think they're criticizing at that point because they're supposed to be filling out the form and giving the review. So sometimes it entails actually saying to somebody beforehand, you know, please, you know, I'm new at this. Please give me some guidance. And if I'm messing up, please... You know that I'm perfectly okay, and actually I would appreciate if you would tell me. Yeah. So sometimes at the beginning of a new job, or if you're having a new housemate or something like that, it's good just to say that at the very beginning so that the person knows that you're receptive. Because sometimes it's very hard to give people feedback when you're afraid that you know, they may have been afraid that you would get angry. You know, they didn't know that you wanted to hear it. So, you know, that could have been something that's going on. I don't know for sure, because, you know, but that's one idea.
I recently identified, I guess, a pattern of anger going way, way back, and it's causing real difficulties and anxiety and just, it's very serious. I so want to change it, but it's almost as if it's a karmic thing that I'm in its grip. It frightens me. And what would you, I mean, I don't know what to even
Okay, so when you can identify a pattern of anger and see that it's been operating for a good chunk of your life. First of all, I would say that's wonderful that you've been able to identify a pattern. Yeah? That is really progress. Being able to identify a pattern of anger is big progress. Yeah? Because most of our anger, I think, has patterns to it, but when we're not aware, then it really feels like it's coming from somebody else and we don't know how to deal with it. When we can see patterns, it's much better. It becomes much easier to deal with. And it may have been going back a long time, but that doesn't matter. It's not you. Okay? It's not who you are. It's not your identity. It's not union oneness with you. It's just some conditioning. It's just a habit. Okay? So habits, conditioning, these are dependent things. Yeah? Because they're dependent, if you condition yourself in another way, if you habituate yourself to see things in another way, the whole thing's going to change. Because this is not who you are.
Thank you.
Okay?
That's good news.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, just following up on that, I've heard an example or a metaphor, I guess, used. I recognize the same pattern in myself, not only just with anger, but any less than good habits or whatever. But the metaphor is that we, like, there's a field and we want to get from here to the house over there, and we've been taking the same path for years and years and years. There's high grass. But over the years, we've been able to stamp down, and now we have this kind of dirt. There's an easy path. I have to put some paths. I mean, but to try something new, new habits and new behaviors, we have to start with the tall grasses, and eventually we
get.
Yeah. That's how difficult it feels.
Yeah. Because when we're well habituated with something, you know, our mind has become very narrow. We've forgotten our creative ability, and we think this happens, this is the only possible emotional response I can have, and this is the only possible action I can take. And our mind is very, very narrow, and I think we have to just expand it. And see, okay, here's the same thing, but, you know, I don't really have to frame the situation the same way in my mind. You know, there are different ways to frame it, and I don't have to do the same thing again and again. Yeah? And so really using our creative ability here to think of, like you were saying, different routes to take. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Could you comment on violent video games?
I think they're horrible and dreadful. I don't understand why we need to spend millions of dollars researching whether they cause children to be aggressive. It's so totally obvious. And I also wonder about the minds. You've got me on my soap gun. I also wonder about the minds of people who create these things. Are these people parents? You know, do they want their own kids watching this stuff? Do they have any kind of social conscience regarding their own children and other people's children? You know, and why is it that our society is so focused on what's going to sell? You know, and I'm going to make it to it so I can sell it because I want a lot of money. And no kind of social consciousness about the effect that it has on other living beings. So that's what I have to say about my games. And if you take me to the place where they manufacture it, I'll tell them to their face. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of a follow-up. Do you know of any programs? I like what you said about like how families teach children. Do you know of any programs or that help children deal with anger? Because what I find is a teacher. I mean, I'm in a situation where there's so much anger in these children. And, you know, it feeds. So the teachers get angry, the children's bad behavior, and there's just the atmosphere of anger on everybody's part. And the kids are watching all of this. I mean, anger is cool. If you don't have the conversation focused, if you just let it go amongst, you know, 12-year-olds, all they'll talk about is styles of fighting. Mm-hmm. You know, you can fight. Yes. So I'm trying to just, if there are any, if you're familiar with any projects or programs that you're helping.
I did hear about a project some years ago. I can't remember the name of it. What was the guy's name? His name was it Mark Greenberg? Somebody Greenberg. But it was some project that he was doing with kids where they're starting them young, helping them to identify their emotions. And so he had different faces, you know, that you use with kindergartners, you know, where they could, like, pull out a different face to show how they feel. And just getting kids starting on the path where they can give a label to what they're feeling. Yeah, I think that's a really good thing. Unfortunately, I can't remember the name of it. But I think, you know, do any of you know, some of you who are teachers or therapists or whatever?
In the chart in the kindergarten classroom, I don't know the name of it.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm sure you can somehow find out, you know, or go to the school counselor and ask. Because I personally feel, because I was a teacher before I became a nun, is that one of the most important things to teach children is how to be a good human being. You know, math and reading and science, they'll pick up, but how to be a good human being and get along and be a good citizen and learn how to resolve conflicts is a skill that people need to learn like any others, and we need to teach it in the family and in school.
And popular media is teaching that.
Yeah, totally.
I watched a group of children today put on a play.
Mm-hmm.
And to be the bad to be is clearly the thing, the role that's most prized.
Yeah. I mean, for me, media ethics is a big thing. And I think the public needs, first of all, you know, one thing is the parents complain about this, what the kids are watching. What do the parents watch for entertainment?
Yeah.
What are parents watching? Violence and sex. Okay? If the parents are watching violence and sex on television, why are they expecting their children to watch anything different? Or behave any different? You know? So I think we all need to start with ourselves and ask ourselves, why do I find violence so entertaining? Why am I completely glued, even to the news, which makes me upset, but I love to watch the news with people getting hurt? Why? Yeah? And I think the public, you know, we all need to do as individuals some kind of contemplation and some kind of holding ourselves back from the influence of the media. And if parents do it, then their kids are going to learn. And if parents start doing it and they start saying something in the schools and they start writing letters to these companies that produce this rubbish, you know, I think people really need to kind of stand up and say, we don't want kids learning this. But to do that as a parent, you have to stop watching the same adult version of the same rubbish. Yeah. But I think it's an incredible thing. Why do we find violence so entertaining? I mean, what happened at 9/11, you know, we were horrified. But if that had been a movie, it would have been an incredible box office sellout, you know. Why? Why do we find that so entertaining when it's not true? Not true. And so horrible when it is true. What is going on in our minds, you know? And also, why do we want to watch television watching other people make love? I mean, my goodness, they're so boring. Don't you think? I mean, why do you want to watch somebody else make love on a television set? I mean, who cares? You know? So I think we have to ask ourselves, you know, why am I attracted to what I'm attracted to? You know, what kind of things am I watching? Do I watch good documentaries? How about do I live my own life instead of watching television and watching the internet and watching other people live lives? Do I live my own life? Yeah. How much of us, how many of us really live our life, and how many of us just watch television watching other people live lives? You know, whether they're made up or real, it doesn't matter. And how about talking to real human beings instead of after dinner, everybody going to their own room with their own TV and their own computer, yeah, for their own entertainment? How about people actually talking to human beings? And I don't mean on a cell phone. Because what I find with cell phones is, you know, you're on your cell phone to make an appointment to meet somebody. You go and meet them, your cell phone rings, and you're talking to somebody else. You know? And so you go to some cafe where everybody's gone together to meet and talk, and everybody's talking on their cell phones to somebody else. Ridiculous. You know? Totally ridiculous. You know, why do you call the same person 5 times a day on the cell phone? So, yeah, I think we need some reflection about technology. Yeah.
Something about the relationship between anger and regret. Anger is internalized.
Ah.
Self and regret.
Okay. Okay, this is a good question. Because until now I've been talking about anger directed at other people, but lots of times we have anger directed at ourselves. And we have anger directed at ourselves often because we don't feel good about actions that we've done in the past. Okay? And so we've all made mistakes in our life. And, you know, I mean, we're sentient beings. We're going to make mistakes. What happens sometimes is instead of regretting the mistake, we start feeling guilty about the mistake. And regret and guilt are two different things. Okay, regret says, I made a mistake. I wish I didn't do it. I want to patch it up. Guilt says, I'm so terrible. I'm so awful. Look what I did. I can't believe what I did. I hope nobody else finds out. This is so awful. I'm really the worst human being. No wonder nobody loves me. This is just dreadful. I really deserve to suffer, but I don't want to suffer. You know, when we're guilty, well, who, put it this way, who is guilt all about?
Me,
isn't it? It's all about me. And we'll sit there and feel guilty and go spin around our guilt. And we never resolve the situation. We just sit there and feel guilty. And what I've discovered in my own mind is there's one part of my mind, the logic in my mind that says, the more I can make myself feel lousy, that much I'm doing some kind of penance on how bad I was. Okay? So the more I can hate myself and feel guilty, then somehow I'm doing some penance. But, you know, that doesn't make any sense. That's totally stupid, you know? I mean, it's our stupid, ignorant way of thinking. And just to recognize that, you know, okay, we made a mistake. Let's own it. If we can fix it with the other person or fix the situation or make amends, let's do this. Let's learn from it and let's move on. Yeah. And instead of getting guilty, because the guilt just runs into the self-hatred. Yeah. And then the self-hatred is also just another form of self-centeredness. And this is really shocking to realize because we all have a lot of trouble with self-esteem and self-hatred. And to be honest enough to say my self-hatred is actually just my own self-centeredness. Yeah? It's my own self-centeredness just running around in circles all about me. If I can't be the best one, I'm going to be the worst one. But I am special. And to say, you know, look, I am not that special. Yeah? I made a mistake. Everybody does. What can I do to repair it? Learn from it. Do something useful. Hmm? Yeah? Because self-hatred just makes us stuck, doesn't it? Yeah? And it's totally, it's a stupid mind. And like I say, it's just this mind that says, you know, that somehow, you know, if I feel bad, I'm atoning for it. And of course we aren't. Of course we aren't. And so that's what's very interesting in Buddhist purification practice. you know. I would say purification practice is a very good antidote to do when, you know, for self-hatred, because when we do purification practice, we're kind of doing a life review and looking at things that we've done that we regret and purifying them, you know, by having regret, making a determination not to do it again, taking refuge, generating love and compassion for the other person, whoever it was, doing some kind of remedial behavior, you know. So when we do these four opponent powers and we do that, then, you know, we just say, okay, you know, it's finished and let's get on, instead of staying stuck. And what's also very interesting in Buddhist purification practice, you know, if you're doing Vajrasattva practice, by the way, the Abbey has some Vajrasattva postcards that are out. Where are they? They're out somewhere on the table, so you're free to take some of those. But we have a Vajrasattva practice, purification practice, where you imagine the white light, you know, Vajrasattva, the Buddha of purification, is on your head, and white light comes down into you, and then the nature of that white light is blissful. And you imagine that the bliss is what purifies you. And we all go, bliss purifying me? But I did something wrong. I'm a horrible person. I don't deserve to be happy. You know? And that's just rubbish that we've learned somewhere along the line that we have to leave aside. So it's very interesting. If you do the practice for the 35 Buddhas, the prostration practice, didn't I give the loan for that last time I was here or sometime that I did that?
Another,
you know? Can I do that?
Not here?
I thought I did that.
You said tomorrow last time.
Yeah? I thought I did. Anyway, there's a practice of doing the 35 Buddhas, making prostrations to 35 Buddhas, and it's a wonderful practice. You know, because you say the names of the Buddhas and you're bowing to them, and then you do a confession prayer and a prayer rejoicing at the, you know, your own and others' good qualities and virtues, and a dedication prayer. And the whole time while you're prostrating, you're imagining the Buddhas, an incredible light flowing from the Buddhas into you, you know, and all this light is just filling you with bliss and purifying all that negative karma, and it's a wonderful practice. So I think purification practice is very good for self-hatred. Yeah.
What do you suggest for anger that's not necessarily directed towards anyone in particular, but maybe something that's fair, like a health issue or a death that you feel is
okay.
Unfair?
Okay, so when we feel that there's something unfair, like we have a health issue that other people don't have, or we're grieving the loss of a loved one, and, you know, why did they have to die? Okay. So when we're feeling angry about that, what I find very helpful is to remember that I am in cyclic existence, and the nature of cyclic existence is unsatisfactory. So why do I expect everything to be wonderful? I have a friend who reminds me of this sometimes. He's also a Buddhist teacher, and we're good friends, and I'll call him, and I'll say, oh, no, 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 no. And he'll say, children, you're in cyclic existence. What do you expect? Duh. You know. Yeah, I mean, this is exactly what the Buddha's been telling us all along. Yeah? So, you know, a health issue, health issues, result of my own negative karma. Yeah, better I experience the result now than rather in a lower rebirth. And, we can learn a lot from having health issues. Sometimes it can make us much more compassionate towards other people. It can make us, you know, value our life more. It can be a stimulant for practicing the Dharma. You know, a health issue doesn't have to be something terrible. Yeah, when we're grieving the loss of a loved one, everything is impermanent. Yeah, our own life is impermanent. So this is natural. Yeah. There's a story that I really like from the time of the Buddha. And there was one woman who was going around the town clutching the dead body of her infant child. And she was just totally distraught and hysterical because her child died. And asking everybody to bring this child back to life. And of course nobody could. And she comes to the Buddha and she just says, please bring my baby back to life. And the Buddha said, I'll try, but first you have to bring me a mustard seed from the house of a family that has never known death. Mustard seeds in ancient India were very common. Everybody had them. So she went and knocked on the first door. Do you have mustard seeds? Why, yes. Oh, but before I ask you for one, has anybody died in this house? Oh, well, yes. You know, my father died. Next house. Knock, you know. Do you have mustard seeds? Yes. Can I have one? Yes. But, oh, before, you know, I take one. Has anybody died? Oh, well, yes. My grandmother died. You know, and on she went. And then she realized that every single family has experienced the loss of a loved one. And she saw that this is the nature of cyclic existence. You know, why cyclic existence is unsatisfactory. And at that point, she went and buried the child. And I think, if I remember correctly, I think she also ordained. I have to brush up on the story. But she, you know, really took it to heart and turned to the Dharma as a way to solve the grief instead of holding on to it. Yeah? Because sometimes, you know, when we're angry at situations like this, because basically what happens, whether it's the death of a loved one or a health problem, with either of those situations, we didn't have those figured into our calendar for what was going to happen in our life. Did we? Yeah. Those are things that happen to other people. They don't happen to me. You know, at least somebody should have warned me that I had a health issue. Well, basically, as soon as we're born, we should know that we're going to have health issues. Because we have a body, by nature, that gets old and sick and dies. Anybody here never been sick? Yeah, this is the nature of the body. Now, why are we expecting the body to be always healthy? Okay, same thing. You know, the nature of the body is old and sick and dies. We don't have it in our mental calendar for the people we love to die. But, you know, as soon as birth occurs, then death is the outcome of it. Yeah? This doesn't mean we have to be depressed about the whole thing, but just to recognize this is a natural process and it happens. And death is also going to happen to us. Yeah? So it's much more important that we use this as a teaching for ourselves, you know, and how can I work with my mind so that I don't get, you know, and how can I make my life meaningful and develop love and compassion, you know, through learning through from this experience. Okay? This will be the last question.
You spoke about, you know, that we can rely on others for our sense of self and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a way it's, or is this correct that if I'm understanding you correctly, are you saying in a sense to build up a strong ego?
The word.
It seems like, you know, sometimes that it gave the impression if you do have a good sense, a healthy sense of self, and that includes accepting our own mortality and so forth, that it is building up.
It depends what you mean by ego. Ego is a very, very vague word. Okay? I mean, if ego means sense of self, okay, there's a constructive sense of self and there's a destructive sense of self. Okay? We talked about this last night. You know, in order to practice the Dharma, you need self-confidence. But self-confidence is very different than being arrogant and having an inflated sense of self. So I don't know what the word ego means, so it's hard for me to answer that question. But yes, we need to have self-confidence. But we need to have self-confidence that's based on something valid, okay, which is the fact that we have Buddha nature, the potential to become a Buddha. If we base our self-confidence on our good looks, on our intelligence, on our wealth, on our education, on any of these things that are impermanent and transient, it's going to be a setup for losing our self-confidence. But if we base our self-confidence on the fact that we have the potential to become a fully enlightened Buddha, you know, and that then based on that, and that's something that we can never lose, then practicing the Dharma in order to actualize that becomes very possible and very good. Okay, so bodhisattvas, spiritual beings, aren't people who are wimps, you know. You're never going to get to enlightenment being a wimp. Yeah? Yeah, compassion doesn't mean that you're a wimp. No, I'm so loving and compassionate, I don't help anybody, I don't do anything, I don't have any wants or desires. You know, you're never going to get to enlightenment that way. You have to, you know, you have some passion inside, but your passion is directed towards something useful for yourself and others, not towards just the, you know, same old standard greed and resentment and reputation and praise and popularity and wealth and that stuff. Okay? Okay, let's sit quietly for a couple of minutes. I call this digestion meditation. So just reflect a little bit on what you've heard. It will be a very short meditation, so just use it to review what you've heard so you remember it. Dedicate the positive potential that we've created as individuals and as a group. And imagine that as a light at your heart that you let radiate out into the universe, touching all the living beings. And so you share the positive energy that we've created and the results that will come from this good karma, from this merit, we share it with all the other beings throughout the universe. And send out our deepest aspirations that everybody can live in peace within themselves, can live peacefully with each other, that everybody can get in touch with their own inner beauty and potential, and actualize it to become a fully enlightened Buddha. There's some brochures of Srivasti Abbey that are over there, and there's also a picture book, and I think you're going to show the slides about it. And you're all very welcome to come out and visit us. We're starting a monastery in Eastern Washington State, and we welcome people to come and, you know, either for a program that we're having or just to spend some time and experience community life in a Buddhist monastic setting. Thank you. Hasta mañana.
I also wanted to mention that Campbell Chisholm is the author of many beautiful books, which are available here at Hill Park in front of the room if you'd like to take a look at this before you work.
Do you have Working with Anger here?
Oh, yeah.
So you can all get it for your friend.
Yeah.